now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Hauck.
Good evening, everybody, wherever you are in the world at this time, and welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding one's courage to reclaim that which has always, always been in you. I am Dr. James Hauck, and if you would like more information about me, or perhaps if you want to leave me your comments about tonight's show, I invite you to visit our website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And if at some point you'd like to join in the conversation, call the toll-free 9. That's 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I will be taking your calls after the break. And just wanted to remind everybody out there that these broadcasts are podcasted in case you want to go back and listen again, or you can go back into the archives and listen to previous shows that you might have missed. And also, they're now available for download on Audible and Amazon Music. Well, I am very, very happy to be with you here today and every other Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And just in case you cannot spend the entire hour with me this evening, I just would encourage you to go back and listen again. And, you know, you can always listen live on Station 1 on iHeartRadio. So for those of you who are tuning in for the first time, I just want to say welcome to the show. Each and every broadcast is dedicated to our integration of spirituality and our mental health. Now, before I begin tonight, I wanted to give a quick shout out to Thich Nhat Hanh. He is considered the father of mindfulness. He was born on this date back in 1926. He was a Vietnamese Buddhist monk. He was also a peace activist and a prolific author, a poet, and a teacher, who also founded the Plum Village tradition. He was also recognized as the main inspiration for engaged Buddhism, which emphasizes that spiritual practice must be complemented by one's responses to injustice through various means, such as resistance or collective action, and the creation of new cultural forms. And he would have been 97 today if he was alive. So happy birthday. Well, I get asked all the time, first of all, what is reclaiming one's authenticity? And then how does one reclaim one's authenticity? And certainly reclaiming that which you have always had and always been does take great courage. And it takes tremendous inner strength to change from what is known and comfortable to something that is fresh and new. And when you think about it, that which is unknown to us often contains our greatest potential for remembering who we truly are. And to seek our potential by risking change is the path of true greatness, because such action brings wonderful favor and untold blessings. Now, unfortunately, we often do not see courage in ourselves because we either want to hang on to the past or we can't imagine something better in our lives, let alone discovering who we really are. So in tonight's broadcast, I am using courage as the strength that we already possess that empowers us to let go of those negative attitudes and distorted perceptions that no longer serve us, because they keep us wounded and they keep us victimized. And then once we let go of those things, we then can take on something better, something more life-giving, something more authentic to who we truly are and who we have always been. Or, as my teacher puts it, that until there is an acknowledgement of our spiritual nature, we will not do the work that is necessary to eradicate the ignorance that binds us. In fact, we will continue to experience the changing joys and sorrows associated with the temporary and the false states of consciousness and seek gratifying pleasures that only seek to soothe our sorrows. Which, by the way, always brings us back to answer the question, so how are we nurturing our relationships, personal and professional, especially in terms of forgiveness, gratitude, and love? Ironically, we often receive our deepest physical, emotional, psychological, and yes, even spiritual wounds in and through relationships. And yet, we can discover our greatest healing and strength and peace and forgiveness and love through healthier relationships. And these relationships just might be within our own families. They might be with our co-workers, our colleagues, our friends. Because when we transform, we also transform others by our presence, our grace, and our understanding. And we may not even be aware of it. But first, forgiveness, kindness, and compassion begins with how we treat ourselves. Because when we are compassionate with ourselves, we then can be more compassionate with others. And when we are forgiving with ourselves, we then can be more forgiving with others. And when we're able to live in gratitude with ourselves, we then discover how this opens up our hearts to see and to live in gratitude with others. So all in all, first and foremost, transformation begins with us. Well, I'll be taking your calls in a little while, like I said, after the break, because I really want to hear from you on today's subject, blessing the liminal space, tapping into our highest self. Well, I trust that your season of autumn is going well. And to start things off tonight, I just have a quick question. How many of you have ever gone through some sort of transition in your life? Okay. How many of you have ever gone through some sort of transition in your life? I mean, all of us have, okay? It's not a trick question. It's just all of us, our lives are one transition after another. And now, we may not have had similar experiences in our transition, but we have all gone through various transitions in and throughout our lives, just by simply getting older and facing new challenges throughout our lifespan. Or, you know, we face challenges such as graduations or changes in jobs or careers, promotions, or getting fired or laid off. Or maybe are ready to move from one place to another. Maybe there's transition in our lives from, you know, going from being single to being married or having a life partner. And going from, you know, just, you know, not just, but we're married with no children, and now we do have children. And then we slide into the role of parenthood, and then eventually grandparenthood, and so on and so forth, okay? And when we go through such transitions, I think we often find ourselves in a kind of limbo, or a liminal space, in which there may be a great deal of anxiety or uncertainty, and especially the unfamiliar. And as a result, the people I talk to, some prefer to remain just where they are, unchallenged, and they just want to stay with the familiar, even if it means continuing in suffering, misery, and pain. At least they know it. Well, a basic definition of a liminal space that I prefer is literally the time between what was and the next. It's a place of transition. It's a place of waiting. And as I said before, often includes a time of not knowing. And these thresholds of waiting and not knowing are next are everywhere in life, and they're actually inevitable. And each liminal space ushers in a new chapter of our lives and holds varying degrees of disruption and uncertainty. So basically, liminality and liminal space both take the concept of new beginnings, and it applies it to times of transitions and ambiguities and waiting. But if we look at liminal space in terms of, you know, spirituality and remembering who we are, it becomes a time of embracing the opportunity for growth and learning and spiritual transformation. You see, we no longer need to fear the liminal spaces in our lives, but let's begin to see them as opportunities to remove the superimpositions of those illusions out there and the old patterns of negative thinking and tap into our higher selves. Let's think about it this way. Suppose we have never been in a liminal space. Okay, suppose we've never gone through a transition. Okay, let's just suppose we would stop growing, and or we would stop being challenged, and thus we would inevitably stop developing into our fullest potential. Many of you may be familiar with Thomas Merton, who was a Trappist monk who lived during the early to mid 1900s. And he wrote such books as The Seven Story Mountain and New Seeds of Contemplation. Well, in another book entitled Thoughts in Solitude, Merton wrote perhaps his most famous saying regarding the uncertainty of being in a liminal space, as well as the resiliency he believed he needed to remain true to his calling. And he writes, "My Lord God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end, nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think I am following your will does not mean that I am actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope I have that desire in all that I am doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it. And therefore, I will trust you always, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death. I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone." Again, keep in mind that liminal space is that time between the what was and the next. It is this place of transitioning, waiting, and not knowing, but there is also an opportunity to change, to transform for the better. Well, if there ever was a time when people displayed a sense of directionlessness, or anxiety-driven disruption, or a lack of a sense of purpose and direction in life, it certainly has to be within the contemporary times in which we live. And despite that age-old wisdom that material things do not satisfy or guaranteed happiness, society, it seems more often than not, plunges headfirst into the pit of despair and emptiness and pain, always in search of hope, always in search of joy, always in search of some sort of contentment, but looking oftentimes in all the wrong places. Because you see, from my perspective as a clinical and trauma therapist, it appears that not only are people uncomfortable with uncertainty, but also they're not taught how to live in uncertain times. Yet a pattern emerges as we seem to move from one liminal space to another. Now, originating from the Latin word limens, being in a liminal space means to lose everything that you have come to trust. That could be scary right there. Everything that you have taken into consideration and you've put your trust in, and like all of a sudden, wait a minute, where did it go? All of my assumptions have just been shattered. Now what do I do? What can I trust in? Who can I trust in? And so forth. So being in a liminal space also means to lose everything that you have come to trust and understand and know. And there's this uncertainty about what to do next. It's as if you're standing at a threshold and feeling as though you're at an in-between state. And when many people, you know, say that they're in a state of uncertainty or which way they do not know where to go, I often tell them that this is a very good place to be. As long as they remain open, as long as they remain teachable, as long as they are questioning, as long as they are searching, as long as they are seeking, those are all very positive things that we can do while waiting. And although everything in us may resist this or hates it or whatever, it is nonetheless a place we need. A place or state which no longer serves us keeps us from growing. I'll say that again. When we find ourselves in a place or a state or a situation or an attitude, whatever it might be, which no longer serves us, it definitely keeps us from growing, and especially growing into the discovery of who we truly are and have always been. And unfortunately, we may misunderstand this place, so to speak, because we ask ourselves, what did I do wrong? Or did I take a wrong turn? Or, you know, where did I go wrong? Where did I miscalculate things? And so forth. Well, think about it this way. Perhaps you've done everything correctly, and you've outgrown the previous places, or you've outgrown the old ways of looking at things. And perhaps everything that has happened in your life and the decisions made, the sacrifices, the mistakes, the joys, etc., have all brought you to this exact moment. Would you do it all over again? That's the question. Would we do it all over again if everything in our lives, decisions, questions, sacrifices, mistakes, joys, etc., has brought us to this very moment? Yeah, this is something that, you know, my friends and I often kick around when we run out of things to talk about. I know it's hard to believe, but anyway. And of course, somebody will say, hey, if you had $1 million waiting for you at the end of your, you know, whatever, by the time you hit the end of high school, would you go back and do it again? Or would you wait for $5 million and when you turn 50, would you go back and do it all over again and make different decisions? And I flat out say no. First of all, it's ridiculous because, you know, I wouldn't want to do it again because, again, I look at my decisions. I look at my mistakes. I look at the pain that I've suffered. I also look at the joy that I have experienced. I look at the relationships that I have gained. I look at the relationships I have lost. And I would say I would still do it the same way. Because I don't know if I would do it differently. I probably would not have met my wife. I probably would not have my kids. I would not have my grandchild, and so on and so forth. And so there's joy that results from these transitions in our lives, even though, you know, the age-old statement of, would you go back and do it again? If you could, you know, now you take back with you the wisdom that you had in making mistakes and you get the opportunity to make different choices. No, I would do things the same way. I really would. Well, we can, and when we can, I think, fully understand, you know, this kind of a question to ourselves, I think it's easier to live in gratitude, especially during the most troubling times in our lives. And for example, trauma is something that I deal with people, you know, who are just stuck in it and suffering with it all the time. And trauma in and of itself is not a catastrophic event, but rather trauma is the after effect of the perceived or real life threatening situations that measures our ability to survive and thrive in everyday life. But whenever we get overwhelmed, that's when something becomes traumatic. When our resources, our resiliency is just flooded to the point of, I can't cope with this anymore, therein lies trauma. Well, one of the big names out there in trauma research and so forth, Bessel van der Kolk, he categorizes trauma into the categories of big T and little t trauma. He says that big T trauma can be understood as experiences such as war or life-threatening illnesses, violence, physical, sexual, and/or emotional abuse, natural disasters, and so forth. And with such experiences, there is an element of vulnerability to our personal safety and our emotional well-being. Now, little t traumas, he says, fall into a context of everyday or more transitional experiences, such as being promoted or fired at work, or moving to another city to get a better job, okay, or beginning or finishing school, or any kind of changes in the family, or getting married. Yes, lots of liminal spaces. And although there's not an element of threat to our personal safety per se, little t traumas have that potential to be just as overwhelming as big T traumas, especially if, and here's the big if, unresolved traumatic life issues have been accumulating over time. In other words, if we have never dealt with the traumas in our lives, they are just going to stack on one on top of the other. And that accumulation is going to have a very devastating effect the next time, let's say, a little t trauma comes along. Well, from a psycho-spiritual viewpoint, there is a huge difference between big T trauma that results from natural disasters like fires and floods and earthquakes and so forth, versus experiences that have the potential to produce characteristics of both big T and little t trauma simultaneously. And such experiences would include a direct physical or emotional or psychological or even spiritual harm. That is the direct result of the malicious intent of others. And for example, let's just say within hate crimes and genocide, there are also components of justice and accountability. However, when the people responsible for inflicting harm against others are not held accountable, or systems that continue to oppress people are not corrected, the already traumatized people are more likely to emotionally collapse from these additional layers of internalized humiliation or internalized disgrace or self-loathing or shame or ridicule or whatever it might be. And what makes matters worse is that these physical, emotional, spiritual wounds often remain infected, let's say, and toxic when others are suffering similar pain and exploitation. In fact, when such atrocities and suffering and oppression continue to be met with, let's say, silent indifference or willful disregard, societies have a tendency to become numb to the fact that they are the ones that actually encourage some sort of convenient justification of oppressive systems, generation after generation after generation. So in other words, when crimes against humanity are left unchecked, they not only serve to further cement trauma, but also send a dangerous message to other societies that such crimes can be committed in the future without any consequence. You know, people will just have to learn to get over it. And that's a dangerous, dangerous message right there. Because ironically, the potential is there in that the crimes against humanity can produce trauma, which not only stains the soul, but also blindsides future generations with the emotional, psychological, physical, and spiritual baggage of the past. And yet, what effect does trauma have on us as souls? Yeah, most of the time we talk about the symptoms of grief and trauma in the language of physical or emotional terms. But furthermore, if the spiritual component is explored in terms of rebuilding faith and philosophical beliefs that are challenged by losses, then the soul often gets lost in religious language. Because you see, on one hand, it is a good thing, absolutely, to alleviate symptoms. As the majority of people I work with, you know, just they tell me, I just want to feel better. I just want to eat better. I want to sleep better. I want to be in healthier relationships. Yet on the other hand, what if we embrace ourselves as soul and begin to transform the energy of our traumatic experiences through the voice of the soul? And this is where things get a little interesting, because in order to understand ourselves as soul, we're going to first have to suspend our logical or linear thinking. Because you see, ever since the Age of Enlightenment, let's say, we've been trained to verify experiences through our senses. In other words, like, how much does it weigh? What does it look like? Is the behavior predictable? And can we place its role in our finite human understanding? Yet our souls simply do not play by those rules. The soul can never be grasped from a linear understanding of the mind. Never has been, and it never will be. Because still, those who are looking for, let's say, empirical evidence of the soul, believe that unless the soul can be verified by this temporal template, then the soul doesn't exist. But it does. In fact, another important aspect is that when it comes to understanding trauma's effect on the soul, is that a person's soul is eternal, with no beginning and no end. The soul is the one thing that lives on after our physical hearts stop beating and our brain waves cease. The soul lives and has always existed eternally in other dimensions and timelessness in a location that we're told is heaven, where the fullness of God exists in this unfathomable glory or majesty or splendor. And you know, just a side thought, I was just reminded of this here this afternoon, that there are close to 100 scriptural references that indicate to us that God knows us eternally. So, for example, there's one of my favorite passages in, you know, the first chapter, I think it's the fifth verse of the book of Jeremiah. God says to Jeremiah, look, before you were born, I knew you. And before you were born, I consecrated you and set you apart to be a prophet unto the nations. And I can't help but wondering, what did that look like? What does the soul look like? How does God know us? How long have we existed? And so on and so forth. Well, I would really love to hear your heart, let's say, on the liminal spaces where you have been. So again, if you'd like to call in, that number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. I'll be back with you in 1 minute. welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Again, I just want to share with you just a quick word about my next show that's coming up in 2 weeks, Wednesday, October 25th at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It's entitled Vaya con Dios, Go with God. And as I started to become more of aware of my soul's consciousness at an early age, I began to really hear the cries of the wounded in very distinct ways, you know, muffled cries and sobs in various states of consciousness. And this awareness that I had, I believe, was not by accident. In fact, my Native American teacher, who pointed out, you know, my cut finger in his Blood and Ancestors lesson, which you've heard me talk about before, awakened me further on this journey to release the souls that have been trapped by the energy of trauma. And to accomplish this, it was no longer sufficient for me to simply hear their cries, but it was actually time for me to visit the physical places that witness these crimes against humanity. It was now time to transform the traumatic energies and heal the land and release these souls back to God. So tune in 2 weeks from tonight for Vaya con Dios. Well, let's see. In the second half here, let's take a look at the fact that we live in a three-dimensional world. A three-dimensional world governed by time and space and structures and form. And we live in a chronological order of linear time that consists of what we would call past, present, and future, that is experienced through our five senses of sight, sound, touch, smell, and taste. And we're often pulled in the direction of opposites, such as how we are loved or how we are not loved, what we have or what we do not have, how we connect or how do we disconnect? And are we good or are we bad? But you know, we perceive things and people as being good or bad or right and wrong, black and white, all or nothing, and this all-in duality. Well, these polarities are actually a superimposed state of being or limited perception. It's an illusion. It's not true. And here's what I mean by that. And perhaps, you know, we often want to connect with God on this lower level of awareness, okay? And that's fine, you know. One thing that Scripture often emphasizes is that God is more than happy to meet us where we are. But I guarantee you that it is not God's ultimate desire for us to remain there, because there is so much more for us to realize about God and the universe and ourselves. In other words, we ain't seen nothing yet. And this first step in raising our awareness to remembering who we truly are is understanding that we're not the body, but rather we are souls within the body. Yes, God knew us before we were born and knows everything there is to know about us, and yet we have yet to realize these things in ourselves. To see ourselves as souls living in this world. And this is more in line with who we truly are and have always been. And, you know, this might be especially difficult to grasp at first, because no matter, you know, how high our spiritual awareness or spiritual attunement becomes, we're still going to have to contend with this physical form that gets hungry. And we're going to have to contend with illnesses and diseases. We're going to have to contend with feeling pain. And we're going to have to contend with taking a bath. In fact, there is still a lot of work to be done and food to be grown and distributed and prepared and enjoyed. And certainly, we live in a world where medicines need to be developed and people need to be educated and trained in how the body works, as well as how to treat the body when it doesn't work. And certainly, we need to take care of the body as vessels that house our soul. And still, what makes a difference in our lives is when we begin to remember and live as a soul, is that we no longer choose to live in fear of everyday life, let alone not fearing the dying process, because we are eternal. We can walk each day and interact with others knowing that there is more to this life than what our five senses can identify. Because what we see and hear and touch and taste and smell is very beautiful, very good, but it's temporary. And everything else that we do not see and hear and touch and taste and smell is eternal. And as we begin this process of being in a higher dimension relationship with God and moving towards remembering who we truly are and have always been, we are going to be reminded of all the negative psychological, emotional, and spiritual patterns within our relationships that actually keep us stuck in the past. Because it is a daily surrender or saying yes to being led by our soul's desires that connect us with God and the universe. So we can let go of the former in order to take on more life-giving. We let go more easily because we're no longer controlled by the fear, but compelled out of everlasting love and grace. And when we do that, we no longer wish to find peace and grace and love, but rather we become peace and grace and love. And that is a very powerful and transformative vibe we give off. The sense of beingness generates a powerful positive energy field or a vibrant aura. And others can tell this even before we speak. We can probably tell it as soon as we walk into a room or a store or wherever. And when this occurs, we no longer have to worry about what we're going to say in any given situation. We can simply be. And we find ourselves being fully present with ourselves and being fully present with others, as well as begin to experience God in the most unlikely places and through the most unlikely people, which is actually where God has been found all along. I can't tell you the number of times where it didn't matter of the place or the space or the people. God showed up. God made that presence known, and there were tremendous things that had happened. There certainly a transformation had taken place. And you know, this is, you know, one of my favorite things to talk about, because ironically, the first place that we're going to notice this transformation in our lives is how we begin to tell our stories differently. You know, how we tell our traumatic stories certainly indicates that a transformational healing in relationships has occurred that exceeds time and space. And it's more than just recounting facts and dates and figures, but rather our stories carry with them elements of healing, grace, and hope for all of humanity. Well, if you were with me during the last broadcast, I was talking about how storytelling and listening to stories go hand in hand. And some people are just, you know, better storytellers than others. You know, some people stick to a well-rehearsed script, making sure every little detail is shared. And others are just simply all over the place with their thoughts and leaving out important details and, let's say, making up others. And then there are some people who have never shared the story of their lives with somebody else. In fact, some people have never been given the chance, and they've never been given the permission to share stories that lie deep within, underneath their emotional wounds and scars that are hidden from the rest of the world. And when this occurs, helping people find their narrative powers, find their voice, also empowers them to find their healing. Well, I also shared in the last broadcast narrative therapy. It's a style of therapy that helps people become the intuitive expert, as I call it, in their own lives. In other words, there is an emphasis on how our stories are told because people begin to see themselves separate from their problems. Now, an example of this would be to help a person separate what has happened to them as an individual and his or her interpretations or assumptions from who they are as a person who has value, dignity, and worth. So, you see, you might have done some pretty awful things in your life, but does that make you an awful person? No. You're a person who came into this world already equipped and graced with everything you need for this life, but perhaps you have not recognized and embraced your fullest potential. Therefore, you're a person with value, dignity, and worth, of course, but there are times when you act in ignorance of it. You just simply do not know what you do not know. And part of healing from our past not only involves telling our stories, but also involves reclaiming our empowerment to rewrite our stories that are now life-empowering and affirming. And we don't achieve this empowerment from an embellished, delusional view that nicely ties up our stories in a bow. But in all actuality, there are three wonderful benefits to narrative therapy. The first is to place any untold or unspoken moments of a person's life into his or her current story. What haven't they shared before? What haven't they been allowed to share before? And this aspect alone, just that one thing, is very powerful. Now, in her book, The Other Side of Silence, author Urvashi Buthalia noted that when she interviewed survivors of the India partition of 1947, she struggled with, as she says, reaching beyond the stories into the silences they hide. In fact, she questioned if there was some way in which history could ever or would ever make space for the small individual voice. Not just in the words that the person used, but also in between the words, the pauses, the long moments of silence. What was in the silence? And was there a depth to suffering that just goes, beyond words? Well, second, narrative therapy also helps people connect to the emotional content, and they can retell their stories from a head and heart center. They connect with their feelings. They connect with how they interpret or how they understand what has happened to them, their experiences, and so forth. And so narrative therapy also encourages people to tell and retell their stories by this integration of the head and the heart. And lastly, narrative therapy helps people construct new perspectives and insights in relation to how they tell their stories. In other words, are they told from a place of woundedness and pain? Or are their stories told from a place of transformational perspective of finding one's healing and remembering who he or she is? Sounds a lot like reclaiming authenticity. And we can certainly reclaim who we are and reclaim remembering who we are just based on how we tell our stories. From where do we tell our stories? But nevertheless, our physical bodies also go through a change as our heightened spiritual awareness increases. And I think a lot of people tend to forget that. We need to honor that because whenever we go through shifts in our awareness, our consciousness, and so forth, that may also cause us to become, let's say, more tired at times or more sensitive towards light and sound and temperature. I mean, I know people who go through states of hunger or no appetite, and we may even think that we're going crazy. But in all of these experiences, it means that we're shifting into higher consciousness, and the physical body has to adjust in order to handle the vibration. And for me, it feels though time speeds up, and I often become more sensitive to noise. I know something is going on. And, some people often report feeling lighter, which has nothing to do with the bathroom scale. So, how does our DNA shift, let's say on a cellular level? Well, we already know from the research out there that medication, I'm sorry, meditation, there we go, decreases blood pressure. And meditation lowers heart rate and helps in respiration, helps us sleep more soundly. And it does release more oxytocin and endorphins, etc. And even one of my favorite subjects, research in the area of near-death experiences, has shown to affect people in terms of an emotional, psychological, physical, and spiritual, let's say, a benign virus, that they have such a radical shift in their awareness and desires and so forth. But what is this shift that occurs in us moving from, let's say, carbon energy to crystalline energy? Well, it certainly involves releasing unneeded energies and old patterns and replacing them with higher vibrations of love and light. And crystalline energy is the energy of light and love, which means that anything that's not in alignment with love and with our higher vibrational selves will fade away. And as a society, we already know that cell memory occurs when we hold trauma in the physical body. And traumatic experiences, has that potential to change our cells, our genes. It's the study of epigenetics. And a lot of studies came out of traumatic experiences of World War II, or as well as other atrocities, whereby the trauma was, let's say, stamped on a person's DNA and passed along to future generations. And when we shift into higher consciousness, or let's say vibration, that too creates a change in our DNA and can actually break up trauma that has altered our genes. The same is true with our mental health. There is such a thing as crystallized intelligence, which encompasses everything we have learned or experienced or heard or tasted, and the emotions we have felt, positive core memories and negative core memories. And all of these experiences are held in this crystallized intelligence, which has been shown to become stronger and more resilient over time. And this is why listening to the stories from our elders is so crucial for every generation, because within those experiences come precious wisdom teachings that we need to integrate into our lives. But even within something so strong as our crystallized intelligence, there's also unhealthy patterns of behaviors or distorted perspectives that need to be dissolved and released. So, all in all, you're never too old to experience a radical shift in your vibrational awareness of your vast self. And these vibrational shifts certainly show themselves sooner or later in relationships. More people become loving, more patient, more forgiving as they are with themselves and with others. Because when we ascend, it does affect us physically. But when we, let's say, minister to the physical needs of another, it always has a spiritual effect or an awakening on some level. In other words, the soul is also touched. See, this healthier perspective often forms in people a greater sense of identity as well as a deeper sense of compassion and empathy and grace towards others. And healing from intergenerational trauma also has the same effect. Because when healing occurs within the greater context of generations, again, people will tell their stories much differently from a healthier, more holistic perspective. And the reason why we can tell our stories differently is because much of the healing involves becoming aware of the former negative perceptions and that negative self-talk that no longer serves us. In other words, we recognize how these negative cognitive schemas have been draining our energy or distorting our perceptions and diminishing our potential for healthier relationships. Because whenever we replace those with more transformative and life-giving perspectives, what I like to refer to as this starburst of energy heals all generations across time and space. Henry Nouwen, the theologian Henry Nouwen, is often fond of saying that you can tell your story from the place where it no longer dominates you. You can speak about it with a certain distance and see it as the way to your present freedom. And the beauty of our stories is how they change and transform over time, not in the sense of making it up as we go, such as like reminiscing about the good old days or that fish tale that about the one that got away, but rather understanding how we tell our stories differently from a healthier place, a place of hope, a place of peace. And when we're able to do this, we no longer fear the liminal spaces in our lives, but we see them as opportunities to tap into the very best of ourselves. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you have been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Thank you for spending this hour with me. And again, if you would like to leave me your comments about tonight's show or just to, you know, drop me a question or something, I just invite you to visit the website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. So join me in 2 weeks while we will be exploring Vaya con Dios. And until then, everybody be safe out there, everybody behave themselves, and be well. Good night.